Hey, it's Jesse. We've got a really fun holiday show coming up. You know, it's getting to the end of the year. It's the holiday season. Maybe you're feeling generous. Maybe you're thinking about what charities you want to support before the end of the calendar year. I hope that you'll take a second and think about supporting your local public radio station. I mean, 2018 has been a wild-ass year. I feel like there has been four major cataclysmic news changes every day for the past 360-whatever. Think about how many of those you found out about or got context about from your local public radio station. And think about all the times that your local public radio station and shows like this one maybe gave you a little bit of an escape valve, just an opportunity to think about something besides the news. The end of the year is the perfect time to support that station that brings you Bullseye and brings you NPR News and all the other wonderful things that public radio offers. Your support is incredibly important. It's what keeps Bullseye on the air. You can support your local station right now. Here's how. Go to donate.npr.org/bullseye. That's donate.npr.org/bullseye. And thanks. Let's start the party.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Alonso Duralde is a film critic. He writes for The Wrap. He co-hosts the movie podcast Who Shot Ya. He's the author of several books on movies. He's very highly credentialed. He is also extraordinarily passionate about one weird thing. You know those made-for-TV Christmas movies on the Hallmark Channel? Alonso is perhaps the world's leading expert on those. So allow him, a real-deal, authoritative, smart, thoughtful film critic, to make the case for watching them.
It is kind of that deal of when you walk into a McDonald's, when you walk into a Waffle House, you know exactly what you're going to get. And you know exactly what you're going to get with these movies. And they're perfect for, you know, if you are on the sofa with the flu and you fall asleep in the middle of one of them and you wake up in the middle of the next one, you'll still know exactly what's going on and what's already happened and what's about to happen. And there is something very soothing about that.
Ah, it's Bullseye. This week, a brand new Bullseye holiday bonanza. Alonso tells you how to watch the 37 Christmas movies that the Hallmark Channel produced this year. That's just this year. And we're just getting warmed up. We also have Christmas advice from the McElroy brothers, the hosts of the smash hit podcast, My Brother, and Me.
You could toss your keys in with your present. Just have everybody do that. And I think that would probably spice things up.
You'll also hear from Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees about their brand new Christmas album. Mickey grew up listening to Christmas music, but he didn't love it at first.
Yeah, not necessarily because I wanted to, but that's what they put on. Because when you're a kid, your parents run the machine, right?
Plus, soul singer Cy Smith tells us about the holiday song that changed her life. And more. All of that coming up on the Bullseye Holiday Spectacular. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. First up on our holiday special this year, Mickey Dolenz of the Monkees. The Monkees was, of course, a TV show. It aired from 1966 to 1968, a Hollywood version of A Hard Day's Night. Four lovable goofs in a band playing songs, bumming around Los Angeles, solving mysteries, staying in haunted houses. The band members, Davy Jones, Mike Nesmith, Peter Tork, and Mickey Dolenz, weren't a band before the show started. They had to audition for the part, and they were mostly actors. But the Monkees ended up with some legit all-time hits.
Take the last train to Clarksville and I'll meet you at the station. You can be here by 4:30 because I've made your reservation. Don't be slow. I'm a no-no. I'm a no-no. Because I'm leaving in the morning.
So it's not a real surprise that the band lasted a lot longer than the show. They learned their instruments. They started writing their own songs. The whole nine yards. And in recent years, even the snobbiest of rock snobs have come to embrace them. They've just recorded their 13th studio album. It's called Christmas Party. There are standards and covers, but it's also got contributions from Rivers Cuomo, Peter Buck, and more. Mickey Dolenz is the drummer of the Monkees. He also sings lead vocals on many of their songs. Here's the lead track on the album with Mickey on vox. It's called Unwrap You at Christmas. Mickey Dolenz, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Great to be here. I am such a big fan of you, your show, actually all of NPR. I even did a challenge a couple of years ago, big challenge. I'm a huge fan, so nice to be here with you.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you for saying that. I have an important question for you. Do you like Christmas? Are you a Christmas person?
Yeah, I am. Born and raised in the Valley of L.A., not in a huge religious sense, just celebrating the equinox, I guess, celebrating, you know, winter and all that. But yeah, we always had a big, big Christmas.
Do you have fond memories of Christmas when you were a kid?
Oh, of course, yeah. Wow.
Was it in the Valley? Was it like the most classic 1950s suburban Christmas imaginable?
Yes, absolutely. Hit the nail on the head. My mom, we had this huge picture window looking out over the backyard. Small house, but nice big picture window. She would do an incredible painting. She was quite a great artist. And she would do some incredible Christmas. Actually, she did it at Easter also and, you know, other moments. And she would do this beautiful, what do you call it? Not graffiti. A big painting, on the window and then with, poster paint and then wash it off. Oh, yeah. So we actually had very, very classic American graffiti Christmases and Halloweens and Thanksgivings and, all that stuff. Yeah. Very Norman Rockwell.
Did you listen to Christmas music at Christmas time when you were a kid?
Yeah, not necessarily because I wanted to, but that's what they put on because when you're a kid, your parents run the machine, right?
Well, I mean, some of that stuff is really good, especially at that time. I mean,
it's
you
wonderful.
Can't argue with your Nat King Coles and your, the crooners made some really great Christmas music.
Oh, no. And funny you should mention him because he is one of my favorite. My influences vocally, musically, were people like Nat King Cole, Johnny Mathis, who I just met, actually. The Sinatra, who I did meet. My influences were all that stuff. And I love all that stuff.
What was the best Christmas present you ever got as a kid?
Ooh, wow, great question. I think it probably was a Lionel train set, a big one, the original full-size, mass, I don't know what gauge it was, but, and my dad, who was very handy with building stuff, he built me a big platform in the garage where the train set would, be set up. So that was probably it, a big Lionel, a full gauge. I don't know what they're called now, but probably a train set. That was probably it.
Did you get involved in all the mechanics of it? That was like the dawn of computer programming was people who were really into switching their train sets.
Well, back then, it was still steam powered. We had to actually put real coal in the engine. I've always been very, very into building stuff. I have a woodworking furniture company with my daughter called Dolenz and Daughters Fine Furniture, and we make handmade real high-end kind of custom furniture stuff in a workshop that I have. I've always been into it. My dad was, and over the years, I got into it even deeper and deeper, and now I have this business, and I do it for the love of it, you know, and I was going to be an architect. That was my plan.
Really? Because you started acting as a kid. I mean, both your folks were actors, if
right.
I'm remembering correctly. Was that like the family business, or was that something they were trying to keep you away from?
No, quite the contrary. It was the family business. My dad was an actor, quite successful. My mom was a singer, actress, until she started having kids, and then she became a stay-at-home mom, which, thank goodness for us, of course. It was wonderful. But my dad did real well, signed to Howard Hughes, of all people, for a while. And I had my first television series when I was 10. It was called Circus Boy. It was on NBC, a national, you know, big network show in the 50s, about 1955. Around that time of Rin Tin Tin and Flick and Fury and all that, and did very well. We ran two or three seasons until I kind of outgrew the part. And then my parents very wisely, and by the way, they had never pushed me into it. We weren't that kind of Hollywood Beverly Hills lifestyle, which is fine for some. You know, eyes and teeth, honey, eyes and teeth. I was brought up in the valley. And in a very rural suburban environment, you know, I would come home from shooting on the set and my father would say, you have to clean the pool. Had horses on the property and, you know, things like that. So he was from Italy, off the boat from Italy. And my mom was from Texas. So they were kind of no-nonsense people and didn't let me get away with, I was going to say, but I won't because...
Because you know what a classy operation I'm running here.
So, no, they never... I don't ever remember being, you know, pushed and hassled, you know, any sort of pressure at all.
Did you like it? I mean, was it something that you really wanted?
No, I followed in my father's footsteps. But how could you not like, you know, being... Well, that series, Circus Boy, was this kid... The spine of it was that it was an orphan kid at the turn of the century who'd been adopted by a clown in a circus. And they took care of him, and he turned out being the one that would also save the day. So I'm living for 3 years. I was living as a 10 or 12-year-old kid in a circus at the turn of the century. So, I mean, how can you not? Like that. I mean, with an animals, I learned to ride an elephant. And in fact, that was the first thing they said to me. They said, okay, well, you know, you're going to have to ride an elephant. And I said, okay, where do I start? It's kind of like when I got the monkeys, they said, well, you're going to be the drummer. I said, okay, where do I start?
We have a clip of Circus Boy. The show in which you starred as a pre-adolescent, or I guess an adolescent. It was, as you mentioned, about a young man whose parents were killed in a trapeze accident. Your character was named Corky.
Right.
Adopted by Joey the Clown, played by the late Noah Beery Jr. And in this scene, Corky is the water boy to Bimbo, the baby elephant that we've discussed. And in this clip, Corky is there with Bimbo and Joey.
Bimbo, you gotta brush your teeth after every meal. Because if you ever got a toothache, that'd be too bad.
Hey, Corky, have you seen JoJo any place?
Gosh, Uncle Joey, is he loose again?
Oh, you know, he figured out how to open up his cage all by himself. half the time I can't tell who's training who. Here I've been trying to make a clown out of that monkey, and he's making a monkey out of me.
Oh, he'll make a good clown, Uncle Joy. Well, I was teaching him how to put on his own makeup, and you're wagging him. Uh-oh.
Let's go.
Oh, you're so cute. I like that. I like your line delivery. I mean, it is the classicest 1956 right. Child on a television show line delivery like, gee whiz!
Yeah, absolutely right. I ended up doing a lot of voiceovers in the 70s over cartoons, and it was that same kind of thing. You know, it was I was like always the kid named Skip doing Hanna-Barbera cartoons going, whoa, no, look out, here we go, whoa!
Tell me where you were in your life when you got the part on the Monkees.
I had gone back to high school after Circus Boy. My parents very wisely took me out of the business. I had been offered another show, they told me years later. But I was turning 13, going into puberty, and they sent me to a child psychologist. They said it was an educational counselor, but looking back now, I know it was a shrink. With Rorschach and all that. And I guess, you know, he must have said, you must take this child out of the business immediately. Because as we've heard, the horror stories, the problems come with child stars after the fact, not during. During the success, you're glorified. They love you. Everybody loves you, and you're taken care of, cosseted. And then all of a sudden, one day, you're a has-been. You're out of work, and you're just entering puberty, which is tough enough as it is. But now you're not only entering puberty, but you're a has-been entering puberty. And my parents, I don't know, they just wisely, I guess with the aid of this child psychologist, said, no, we're not going to let him do another show. He's going back to school, public school, right off of the set. And I literally one Monday morning, ended up back in junior high school, what they called it then, as a ninth grader, with my roots, my brown roots growing out from my blonde bleached hair from the TV series. And so they threw me right back into the real world. And then after high school, I went to college doing anthropology, psychology, a couple of other. I got into science, you know, I got into electronics and was really getting into science and building stuff. And my father then passed away a year after I got out of high school, which did present some problems, obviously. And I was at a bit of a loose end. I would be doing little guest shots. I had an agent, and the agent would get me a little job on Peyton Place or Mr. Novak or one of these late 50s, early 60s shows. But that wasn't my plan. I was doing it kind of for summer money. And a friend of mine said, you know, we both like building stuff, which we did, both of us. And, you know, I had a workshop even then. And he said, let's be architects and start a little architectural firm. So I enrolled into LA Trade Tech. I just got an honorary award, not award, what do you call it, honorary degree from them. I did about a year and a half, two, three semesters. But in the summers, when I wasn't, you know, going to school, I would do these little TV shows and, you know, guest shots. But I wasn't stupid. I mean, I knew the power of showbiz. I'd had a series. I knew how, you know, valuable and important and life-changing it can be. And so one pilot season in 1965 comes along. And my agent, I had an agent, and I was going to school every day. And he would say, hey, I got an audition for you, 3 o'clock on Thursday, blah, blah, blah. Some I would go to, some I would say, I'm sorry, I got a test, and I didn't. So the Monkee audition comes along. I did, even at the time, sort of since this was kind of different, especially in the fact that you had to be able to sing and play and act to get into the audition or get through it. So clearly they must have had in mind at the time that they were going to kind of, create this sort of, you know, real musical entity, I guess. My audition piece on guitar was Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry. I still do it to this day. And then there was acting and scene study and improv. And the improv I had the most trouble with, mostly uncomfortable. And I am still to this day with improv because I was raised, you know, to learn the script, read the lines and show up and do the scene and go home. And so the audition process was quite extensive. But my agent calls and says, you got the pilot. And I was in school studying to be an architect, and I said, great. And I took off 10 days to do the pilot, and then I went back to school because I knew that 9 out of 10 pilots don't sell. And I wasn't going to take a chance, so I went back to school studying to be an architect. And then when we got the order for the first season, the 26 episodes of the first season, I decided I better quit school.
More of the Bullseye Holiday Special still to come. Stay with us. Cy Smith, Alonso Duralde, the King of Christmas Movies, the McElroy Brothers, and more. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. In 1980, with a few thousand dollars and used dairy equipment, Ken Grossman founded Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. Ken's award-winning ales propelled him from home brewer to craft brewer. Today, Ken and his family still own 100% of the company, one of the most successful independent craft breweries in America. More at SierraNevada.com.
Cube-shaped wombat poop, an elevator to space, and a karate kickin' cockroach. I'm Mindy Thomas of NPR's Wow in the World podcast. And every Monday this December, we bring you all new scientific wows to share with the curious kids in your life. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, Maximum Fun. I am Oliver Wong, scholar, journalist, DJ, etc.
And I'm Morgan Rold. I'm a music supervisor who loves stilettos. We host Heat Rocks, a music podcast where we talk to influential artists and scholars about the albums that changed their lives. On our most recent episode, we had the chance to talk with none other than R&B legend Macy Gray about one of her favorite albums, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy by Yeezy.
We get deep talking about everything from Kanye's college dropout days all the way up to his most recent shenanigans.
I just think it's weak, and I don't think he has to do that, and I was just disappointed.
So make sure you, dear listener, are subscribed, because you definitely do not want to miss this conversation.
Heat Rocks every Thursday right here on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to the Bullseye Holiday Special. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm here right now with Mickey Dolenz. He's one of the singers and the drummer for the Monkees. The band just released a brand new holiday record. It's called Christmas Party. Let's hear another song from it. This one is called What Would Santa Do? I have a clip from the TV show The Monkees, and it's from an episode called The Monkees Watch Their Feet, in which you, Mickey, are abducted by aliens. In a classic monkey storyline.
Yeah.
So we're about to hear you. You are on a – you've been beamed onto a flying saucer. You are then cloned by the blue-skinned captain and his assistant. Then your evil robot double is unleashed back into the world to spy on the other monkeys, Peter Tork and Michael Nesmith.
Right.
Let's take a listen.
Hey, Mickey, isn't that a spaceship over there?
No, it's the powerfully persuasive argument of a space alien.
What does a spaceship look like? Well, I don't know. I never saw one before.
Then how do you know it is a spaceship?
He's right, man. Probably some new drive-in.
The only way to recognize an alien is to take note of strange behavior. Just take some notes on this next scene.
Hello, Sonic. I'm here in enemy headquarters. They have harmonic destructors here, like we do on Zlodnik, and when they use them, they emit terrible and horrible sounds. They also have insufferable tortures here on Earth. Whenever a pussycat cries, they tear off its head.
Definitely not.
Then they holler in its ear. And then they put the head back on the body. I don't know how it stays alive.
Mickey? Mickey, who were you talking to just then?
No one.
Well, you're acting very strange, you know.
I'm not acting strange. I'm acting perfectly normal. There's nothing strange about me. Don't tear off that cat's head again. I can't stand it.
It is a lot of nonsense for a television show in the mid-1960s.
Oh, boy, a lot. But, you know, interesting you should say that. If you look back, and I've studied it, I've done lectures now, people have asked me, you know, for years, you know, what was it? How was it? How did it happen? It wasn't that, if you look back, it really wasn't that, surprising, because the producers had made some very clever early on decisions when they were doing their Bible, which is the essence of a show. For starters, and funnily enough, I was just listening to an interview you did with Eric Idle, who I know I've known for years, and he was talking about Monty Python's, and he mentioned how the humor was not topical. The monkey's humor was not topical, nor was it satirical. And I think that's one of the reasons why the monkeys and Monty Python and I Love Lucy and other shows stand up for so long, because they're not topical. And that was a conscious decision that the producers made. We're not going to talk about anything in the news this week. We're not going to do anything too satirical. It was another friend of mine, a guy named John Lennon. Oh, did I drop that name?
I'll grab it for you.
I got it. Who said the monkeys were like the Marx Brothers. And if you look at the monkeys show, the project, the whole thing, as this sort of half-hour Marx Brothers musical movie on television, everything makes a whole lot more sense. If you think of an old Marx Brothers movie where everybody ran around and danced and sang and had a plot and there was a bad guy and a good guy and people were doing silly stuff, and, you know, that scene you just played could have been right out of a Marx Brothers movie. We were screened Marx Brothers movies during the preparation process, for instance. So it was not coincidental. I mean, there was some thought put behind this, that the show would not be topical, it would not be satirical, because that would date it very quickly. And also, a very important point, I think, is that the monkeys were never successful. It was the struggle for success, because that I think is what it endeared it to all those kids around the world, was that we represented all those kids in their garages, in their basements, in their kitchens, you know, wherever, in their garage, trying to be the Beatles. And that is essentially what the Monkey Show is about. This band that wanted to be the Beatles. And on the television show, we never made it. It was always the struggle for success that I think is, like I say, one of the things that endeared it to so many people.
Did you want to be a lovable Marx Brothersian goofballs, or did you want to be cool rock stars when the possibility that you actually maybe could be cool rock stars came up?
In my case, it was I woke up one day and I fell asleep one night as a working actor, entertainer, singer, you know, musician, because I had to do all that. And I woke up in the morning as a cool rock star. and I was like, whoa, when did that happen? It's kind of exemplified in a story I've told a bunch of times. During the show went on the air in September of 26. what century are we in here? In September of 66, and we'd been filming since June or July, and recording, of course, all the time, day and night. I was doing most of the lead singing. So I would go on the set from 7 in the morning to 7 at night and then have dinner and then go into the studio and record a vocal, sometimes two or three a night, and because they needed so much material for the television show. And that Christmas, that this time, that year, 66, they gave us a hiatus to the show had been on the air since September. We'd heard that it was doing very well. We'd heard that Clarksville had gone to number one, but we're working 12, 14 hours a day. In those days, of course, without social media and all that other kind of stuff, you know, I'd get in my car in the parking lot and drive home and never see anybody, never interact. The fans didn't know where we were or how to find us, you know, if you just went home. And that Christmas, I was going to drive up to San Jose, where my parents and family lived at the time, with my Christmas presents and have about a week or 10 days, whatever it was, off and a little hiatus. So I get my little Christmas list together and I get in my car and I drive down to the local mall there in the valley in Los Angeles, where I'd shopped every year for decades with my family. And I get out of my car with my little list and I walk through the big glass doors and all of a sudden people come running at me screaming. And I thought it was a fire. And I'm holding open the door going, slow down, don't run, don't panic. It's so I literally did think it was a fire and they were running at me. And I had to leave. I was really pissed off. I had to go and give my Christmas list to my roadie and have him go do the shopping. Got in my car and had to go home. Well, that was the first inkling that I had of what was going on.
I mean, it sounds neat, but it also sounds hard.
Oh, it was a lot of work. Oh, boy. Each episode took 3 days and then start the next one the very next day. And then we started rehearsing for the concert tour because they obviously had in mind that if this thing happened, they wanted us to be able to play or they would not have cast people that could. They wouldn't have bothered. They would have just cast actors and done it all, everything else, you know, kind of old school. But they clearly had in mind that they wanted, they hoped that if the thing happened, if the show went, that we would go on the road and perform. And sure enough, you know, we did. And our first concert was in Hawaii, in Honolulu, at the HIC Auditorium. I don't know how many thousands of people were there. And I think that their plan was, well, if we do it in Hawaii and it doesn't work, no one will know.
We'll have 3 weeks before news reaches the mainland.
That's right. But it did, and it was huge. Mike Nesmith, I think, put it very, very succinctly once. He said, you know, at that point, Pinocchio became a real little boy.
Mickey Dolenz, thanks so much for being on Bullseye. It was great to get to talk to you.
Well, I hope that was okay for you guys. Thank you.
When the snowman brings the snow, well, he just might like to know he's put a great big smile on somebody's face. If you jump into your
Mickey Dolenz. The Monkees' new holiday album is called Christmas Party. It's out now. Here's one more song from the record. It's called I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Alonso Duralde is the film critic for The Wrap. He's a panelist on our very own Who Shot Ya podcast about movies. He's also the author of the books 101 Must-See Movies for Gay Men and, more importantly for our purposes today, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. He's one of the leading experts, perhaps the leading expert, on Christmas and holiday movies. And when it comes to Christmas movies, one company has dominated the market. The greeting card, folks, over at the Hallmark Channel. Over 150 Christmas movies made, and Alonso has watched nearly every single one of them. This year, they have 22 brand new feature-length Christmas movies. Alonso's been watching them all. Alonso Duralde, welcome to Bullseye.
Thank you. Actually, 37 this
year.
Holy
cow!
22 on Hallmark Channel, another 15 on Hallmark Movies and Mysteries.
Holy cow. What does that even mean? Like, at the point where you're making 37 of them, are they still even movies?
You know, I like to think of them as a shared universe. You know, this year, an episode of Black Mirror won an Emmy for, like, best movie. So I'm thinking, if an episode of a TV show can be a movie, then these movies could all be episodes of TV shows. And there's such a uniformity to this that I think there's as much of a Hallmark shared universe as there is a Marvel cinematic universe.
This is a shared universe where the signature quality is a variety of different competing Dean Cains?
Pretty much, yeah. And it is the constant messaging is like, if you're in New York and pursuing a career, something's gone terribly wrong.
Okay, so how many Hallmark Channel and Hallmark Christmas, what's it called? Hallmark Mysteries
Hallmark
and Movies?
Movies and Mysteries.
Hallmark Movies and Mysteries Channel movies have you seen?
So far this year, you know what? I'm going to check my app because there's an app now where they list all of the movies and then, you know, it'll ping you in case, God forbid, you should forget. So according to the app, of the total 37 films, I have seen 23 of them.
What are the essential qualities of the Hallmark Christmas movie? What is their promise to the consumer?
Well, you know, for the most part, they deal with a young woman who lives in the city and is following a career where she is successful but not personally fulfilled. She is then called back to either her own hometown or another small town where her business is doing business. And over the course of that trip, she will cross paths with a guy who is usually very good at fixing things. You know, whether it's her car or the local gazebo, because there's always a gazebo, and he will sort of sweep her off her feet with his proletarian charms, and by the end of the film, she will rediscover her love of Christmas, her love of not living in a big city and pursuing her career, and they will settle down in a perfectly beautiful, quaint small town that has no chain restaurants, coffee shops, or big box stores.
Let's take a listen to a little bit of the trailer of the Hallmark film Christmas Land.
Children, I love Christmas so much that I created this entire holiday village for you and your families to come and enjoy.
I'll never forget it.
Jules Cooper.
I mean, I had high hopes for this campaign, but I must say, I am thrilled. It is turning out better than I possibly could have hoped.
Thought she was on her way to having everything she wanted.
Perfect.
Did you see this letter? Marked third notice urgent. Mrs. Glinda Stanwyck?
It's Grandma Glinda.
Until one Christmas.
I inherited Christmas Land.
So that's kind of an plot for the Hallmark movies. A woman who, as a child, loved Christmas, loved hanging out with her grandmother who loved Christmas, but now is a high-powered marketing exec in New York. But she finds out that she has inherited Christmas Land, which is a big Christmas tree yard and a sort of theme attraction around the holidays. The big question now being, will she come in and take it over and bring it back to its former glory the way her grandmother did, or will she sell it to a developer to build condos?
What are the very best Hallmark Christmas movies that you have seen? Are there any that you would recommend someone who is not already a fan of the genre? Enjoy.
You know, it often comes down to the intangibles of who's in it. And, you know, and other little things like that. Like, for example, Christmas Land is one of the better ones because the leads are Nikki DeLoach, who always seems to have a sense of humor that goes beyond the production. Like, she's in the film, but she's also maybe standing a little bit outside the film and commenting on it in a way as she's performing it. And then the male lead is Luke McFarlane, who I think has a touch more humanity than, as you say, the army of Dean Cains that we usually get in these films. So that one's kind of fun, but again, it is very much, it is, if you want to connect the dots of how, like, a classic Hallmark, you know, narrative goes, that's a good one to watch. McFarlane also pops up in a movie called The Mistletoe Promise, which is an interesting film because no one is really having to, it's about two professionals and neither of them has to give up their job or the big city, but they kind of get each other through the Christmas season because Jamie King plays a divorcee who is running a travel agency that she has to run with her ex because they split it in the divorce. And McFarlane is a lawyer who's trying to get a promotion at work. He isn't being taken seriously by the boss because he is a singleton because he's been so work obsessed. And she is tired of having her ex-husband flaunt his like hot new girlfriend in her face all the time. So they have this agreement with each other where they're going to be each other's fake relationship and take each other to all the many holiday functions that, you know, couples are expected to do during the season. And of course, wouldn't you know it, they fall in love. The fake boyfriend slash fiance, also a very popular trope in these movies.
Are there other holidays represented in the canon? Are there Hanukkah or Saturnalia Hallmark movies?
We have been promised one and possibly two Hanukkah movies for next year. I think Hallmark, the thing about these movies is that they've been really popular for years. Like Hallmark does its biggest numbers at the end of the year. They start showing these movies before Halloween and running them all the way through the end of the year 24/7, which is why they have to make so many every year because they've got to feed that beast.
I mean, I see sometimes here in Los Angeles, my NPR colleague and friend Linda Holmes.
Oh, when she's a big fan. Yes, I follow her on Twitter.
When she's out here for the television critics gauntlet,
right,
which is like 10 days where they learn about every new television show in the upcoming year. Every year, the Hallmark Channel puts on like a gargantuan Christmas in June celebration where they buy out the Beverly Hilton or whatever and turn it all Christmassy to promote these things.
Oh, yeah. No, they've got the brand going for sure. But I think what's happened in the last couple of years is that because people like Linda and other people who are in the entertainment media have been paying serious attention to these movies, with that has come a bit more of a critical eye, part of it being, wow, there's a lot of white people in these movies. And, you know, you get these sort of side characters I like to refer to as the BFOP, which is Black Friend on Phone, which is the supportive coworker or boss or whatever who spends the entire movie on the phone with the white heroine encouraging her love life because she has got nothing else going on in her own life. They're making improvements in that category. You know, this year, I think there are of the 37 new Hallmark movies, three of them have black couples at the lead. Two of them have Latinx leads. So, you know, they're getting there. And for 2019, we are promised some Hanukkah films. So I really can't wait to see what sort of new cliches we get for this holiday that they haven't really tackled before.
I'm interested to see how this formula tackles the collectivist economic ideology of Kwanzaa.
Not holding my breath on that one, but you never know. I would love a Yule film or we're all celebrating the birth of Mithra, you know, whatever it is.
I've watched like a scene or two on YouTube or whatever. Mm-hmm. The thing that surprises me is, you know, I mean, it doesn't surprise me because these are professional productions, but like the level of competency is very high. These are real skilled film and television performers, writers, directors all around, and they've spent enough money that it's not awful.
Right.
But I guess to my mind, like, the reason I would watch it would be camp. So if you take camp away from me, all that's left is Drudge.
You know, I think comfort is not to be underrated here. You know, there is something, it is kind of that deal of when you walk into a McDonald's, when you walk into a Waffle House, you know exactly what you're going to get. And you know exactly what you're going to get with these movies. And they're perfect for, you know, if you are on the sofa with the flu and you fall asleep in the middle of one of them and you wake up in the middle of the next one, you'll still know exactly what's going on and what's already happened and what's about to happen. And there is something very soothing about that. And, you know, it is encased in a packaging of wreaths and twinkle lights and small town tree lightings and carolers and all that kind of seasonal stuff that for a lot of people who live in the city or live in a place where it never snows or whatever, there is just a sort of a comforting thing to that. I mean, my husband, who refuses to watch these movies, loves the Shaws of Sunset. You know, he calls them his TV friends. So, you know, I think everybody has that thing where we can't defend this piece of art or entertainment, but, you know, we get something out of it.
I have an almost romantic relationship with Crook and Kipe, the television play-by-play voices of the San Francisco Giants.
There you go.
Now, on Hushatcha,
yes,
the three of you are rarely afraid to take on the identity problematics of film and television.
Sure.
What's it like for you as a guy who is not part of the hegemonic cultural group? You know, you're a man, but you're not straight.
Right.
And I don't know if you grew up in one of the towns depicted in this or in a place that would valorize that. I can't speak to that. But like, as a gay guy, you're not being depicted in all?
Pretty much.
These films.
Yeah. But, you know, I have a lifetime experience of being ignored by the mass media and of looking for tiny clues, which is part of the fun of these movies. Like, for example, in The Road to Christmas this year, where a young TV producer is trying to get the three adopted sons of a Martha Stewart type TV host back together to surprise her during her live Christmas Eve special. When they finally find the third brother, he is running an animal shelter with another gentleman. And you just look at these guys and you're like, you're supposed to be gay, right? Like, there's definite, your movie's not telling me you're gay, but I can tell there's a million little clues here that are tipping me off to this. And so, yeah, would I like to see a queer Hallmark movie? Totally. But at the same time, I think I would be more likely to pick holes in it, whereas these movies are so blandly heterosexual that I have no dog in that hunt, and so I can just sort of sit back and not mind whatever it's getting wrong about human relationships because it's not me.
Let's address a couple of broader Christmas film questions in a sort of rapid-fire fashion since we have the king of the Christmas movie sitting here. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie?
Undoubtedly.
What makes a movie a Christmas movie?
I mean, I think there's no one answer to that one. Usually, obviously, being set during the Christmas season has a lot to do with it. Often, I find that they are stories about redemption, whether it's Scrooge becoming a better person or George Bailey understanding the significance of his life, or even Kevin McAllister coming to understand that he does love his family after all. And so I think Die Hard fits that category because at its core, it's about an estranged marital, about an estranged married couple coming back together and rediscovering their love for each other during a Christmas Eve terror situation.
What is an alternative film to bring up when someone won't shut up about Die Hard being a Christmas movie that, like Die Hard, fits your definition of a Christmas movie and, like Die Hard, is actually pretty good, but unlike Die Hard, hasn't been run into the ground?
Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut.
Oh, wow.
Shot entirely set entirely during Christmas, I should say. Who knows? They shot it for like 4 years. But yeah, the whole movie takes place around Christmas time. And, you know, if we are to believe that Stanley Kubrick does nothing by accident, this is a guy who made some poor PA physically type out all of those "all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy" pages. It means something. And so, you know, you go back and look at that movie again and you'll see almost every scene has Nicole Kidman wrapping presents, or, you know, like the wall at Sidney Pollack's, you know, decadent party that's just like covered with twinkle lights, or, you know, decorations in the street or Christmas trees in the prostitute's apartment or whatever. Like, it's Christmas throughout until the final, the famous closing line of the film that's delivered in the middle of a toy store.
What is the everybody knows it Christmas movie that you will ride for forever?
You know, I think that It's a Wonderful Life, despite its ubiquity and despite constantly being praised as this extraordinary piece of American cinema, is an extraordinary piece of American cinema. Time will not wither nor custom stale the many things that it has to say about humanity and about the holidays and about how we consider our own lives. It is as iconic as A Christmas Carol at this point, I think, and is as powerful a piece of storytelling.
Alonso, I've got to go, and I know you have to go a-wassailing. So Thanks for joining me on Bullseye.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Alonso Duralde, along with the great April Wolf and Ricky Carmona, he hosts Maximum Fun's podcast, Who Shotcha? His book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, is also wonderful. Go check those out. The piano music you're hearing right now is by our friend Brent Weinbach, by the way. He is a professional stand-up comedian, one of the funniest there is, a genuine, brilliant genius of stand-up comedy. He also, for many years, was a professional piano player. In fact, I think that he was one of those piano players who plays the giant grand piano in the Nordstrom department store. Anyway, he has a collection of Christmas songs that he recorded on his piano at home. It's called Christmas Piano, and it's available to listen to pretty much anywhere you go streaming-wise. So here's comedian Brent Weinbach tickling the ivories in a distinctly not funny manner. The Bullseye Holiday Special continues after a quick break. More music from our friend Brent Weinbach, holiday advice from the McElroy brothers, and the holiday song that changed singer Cy Smith's life. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Welcome back to WKEP at Night. Up next, looks like we've got a PSA from local forest ranger Duck Newton.
Do I start now or?
Yeah, lean in, Duck.
Yeah, sorry. Okay, I wanted to address the unfortunate situation that, okay, listen, two people, good people that I and a lot of y'all have known our whole lives are dead, torn to shreds by
a savage, bloodthirsty beast that defies human comprehension. If you'd like to know more, stop by the Cryptonomica, Kepler's premier museum of the macabre, just off Highway 20.
Come on, we just wanted to warn y'all, to beg you, if you see one of those things out in the forest, don't fight, don't scream, run. Run as far as you can.
Doc, it's almost midnight. Listen, folks, if you see anything, please go to thelamplighter.org and let us know. And get behind a locked door tonight.
Anything else we need to... Oh, they're leaving. Okay, well, that's thelamplighter.org, and stay safe out there, Kepler.
Hey, gang, Jesse again. The end of the year is coming. Right now is the perfect time to support your local public radio station. We're making it very easy for you. Go to donate.npr.org/bullseye to support your local public radio station. Again, that is donate.npr.org/bullseye. And thanks. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. It's our annual Bullseye Holiday Spectacular this week. When the holidays roll around, we love to get some pertinent advice from our friends, the McElroy brothers. Justin, Travis, and Griffin are the hosts of the smash hit podcast, My Brother, and Me, right here at Maximum Fun. They have joined me from their various disparate points across this great nation. Travis, Griffin, Justin, welcome back to the show. Nice to have you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You, I treasure this. It's my favorite Christmas tradition.
Mm-hmm. We've been doing it since we were toddlers, actually. Jesse, a teenager, a local teen, would come into our home. That's right. Jesse's 55 years old. He would come to our home and ask us for holiday advice.
I mean, imagine. I it's been my holiday tradition for many years to travel the nation gathering questions for this, even back when I was a teen.
Yes, that's why they called him Jesse Question Seed. You'll just travel the countryside collecting questions.
Here's something from I Didn't Keep the Receipt. So, I got my boyfriend a Polaroid camera for Christmas, and it's already neatly wrapped and underneath the tree. However, today he told me he's planning to buy that same camera for himself. How do I convince him not to buy the camera without letting it slip that that's what I got him?
I thought for a second you were going to say, however, today I looked at the calendar and realized it was 2018 and oh no, what have I done?
Last year, I thought to get my wonderful niece, Charlie, this little kid's camera. So I called my older brother, Justin. I said, Justin, does she have this? And he said, no, of course not. And then when we arrived at their home for Christmas, she totally did. So now it's going to be a future present for my daughter. So maybe you could re-gift this camera to somebody else. Or, I don't know, just say like, hey, don't buy that because Santa.
That's the traditional approach, yes.
Don't buy anything because Santa.
Have you guys tried using the Santa excuse with your romantic partners?
Unfortunately, Santa can't bring the one thing my wife wants for Christmas, which I've got her little note to Santa right here. It says she wants just like a second. Please, just 1 second.
And you've only got two, right, Justin?
We have two children, which is so many.
Try upgrading by 50%, my friend.
Now, Jesse, I can't repeat your mistakes. That's why the older generation is there for my generation to learn from them.
You ever seen that movie Misery? Because I feel like that could be a great solution to this problem.
Like, what? Tie your boyfriend down, break his legs so he doesn't go buy a Polaroid. But Griffin, you're forgetting about one thing. Amazon.com.
Also, he kills her at the end.
Okay. Well, I guess you're forgetting about two things, then.
Yeah.
Return the camera, get a tiny scanner so he can make those pictures relevant to this year in which we live, 2018 AD.
Oh, no, but Justin, what if the question asker returns the camera and gets a tiny scanner, but then the boyfriend doesn't buy a camera and instead, I guess, also gets a tiny scanner?
Oh,
Henry.
Okay, here's something from All I Want for Christmas is Tunes in Texas. I love Christmas music.
I want a Zoom to go with my Polaroid camera.
And I hope they got the wood grain. I love Christmas music, and I broke out my Christmas playlist at 12:01 a.m. on November 1st this year.
Wow.
Wow.
My girlfriend, however, does not like Christmas music because she's worked in retail for so long and had to hear it all day, every day during the Christmas season. How do I convince her to get on board, or at least to tolerate my Christmas jams?
I have found, if you are willing to dig a little deeper, there's a great movie about this called Jingle Bell Rocks, about the vast loads of Christmas music that have not become wildly overplayed over the years. And if you dig a little deeper, there's some fantastic Christmas music, holiday music, however you want to slice it, that is out there that has not been just like done to death. That's still very excellent. It's just like not completely 1,000% overplayed like some of the classics.
The director of that film is a past Bullseye guest. You can listen to a past Bullseye holiday special to
hear. Here he goes. Oh, God, Jesse, just like one segment without it. Come on, man. Come on. You know what I want for Christmas? Less wild self-promotion.
I want you to be mindfully present in this segment.
Thank you.
I tell you what they're not blasting over the PA at Barnes & Noble is traditional, nearly ancient Christmas hymns. Get some of those going in there. I'm talking about these five stanza babies.
Oh, yeah.
You can also go deeper into the classics to get to some of the verses that maybe we don't always get to. This is an actual verse. I was recently reading the lyrics of Jingle Bells. This is an actual verse.
Oh, it gets buck wild.
A day or two ago, the story I must tell, I went out on the snow, and on my back I fell. A gent was riding by in a one-horse open sleigh. He laughed as there I sprawling lie, but quick. Drove away. What? Excuse me.
That's just cruel.
You had an America's Funniest Home Video in the middle of Jingle Bells all these years and nobody knew.
Anyways, Merry Christmas, I guess.
That's how Dr. Atkins died. That's not funny.
Apparently it is to Justin.
It's kind of funny.
Here's something from Santa's future stepson. Was mommy really kissing Santa Claus, or was it just their partner dressed as Santa? Last year, I listened to the holiday classic, I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus, and had a realization that the reason Daddy didn't see Mommy tickle Santa was because Daddy was Santa. When I brought my findings to my friends, they said I was wrong, and it really was Santa that Mommy had smooched above his beard so snowy white. Who is Mommy kissing? Is Santa real and a homewrecker, or is Mommy just into Santa play?
Are they kidding?
No, I you can't say definitively whether Daddy is Santa, but I think we can all agree Santa is Daddy.
Thank you. Griffin has hit upon the possible third option here. Santa Claus is your dad.
Yeah.
In this song, this person figures out.
I was saying it in the internet sex way, but yeah.
In a sexual manner.
In a sexual manner, that's possible. Santa's a major daddy. We can all agree on this. There's no argument here. I'm saying this song is from the perspective of a Fred Claus.
Or an Arthur Christmas.
Or an Arthur Christmas. Thank you, Travis, who finds out that he is, in fact, Santa's son.
Oh, okay. Okay, here's the pitch. I call the movie I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus. A boy doesn't know his father. His father's never been around. Oh, what's that? His father's Santa. Green light, green light, green light. I'm thinking 15 mil. Get back to me. Let me know what you think.
Was green light, green light, green light a series of green lights in different media?
Yes.
Film, television, full motion video gaming?
It was film, television, and McDonald's toys.
Did you all know that a live-action version of this film was adapted in 2002, starring Connie Selica and Corbin Burnson? Swear to God. They did a whole movie.
It blows my mind to even consider that this song, that it's not the person's dad.
After a boy sees a man in Santa Claus suit kissing his mother, he thinks that the real Santa wants to replace his father, so he goes to prank war with him. What?
Wait, what?
Hell yeah.
Excuse me?
How does that last longer than, say, one prank?
Are you kidding me?
That's a verse of the song I hadn't heard.
Yeah. Apparently it's a prank war with Santa.
Man, I will say this. Santa Claus, when he does his job in your house, makes himself vulnerable pretty much the entire time he's in there.
Yeah. I mean, his ingress is a, like, pit of fire. There's a lot of easy ways to kill Santa. I've thought about this a lot.
A strange note to end on, but...
Here we are.
Here's something from Distressed in D.C. Last year, when flying home, I was stopped at airport security because I had a wrapped gift in my carry-on bag. After being cleared as no threat to national security, I remarked to my girlfriend that it was weird they stopped me for that. She said, "Everyone knows you can't bring a wrapped gift through security." I disagree. My question is, why aren't wrapped gifts allowed? Surely they can still see through them with their X-ray machines. emphasis mine. I'm not using lead-lined gift wrap. Please help me understand so I can put this behind me.
Are they checking it? Are they checking the wrapped gift?
It's carry on. They explicitly do say that.
Okay, good.
I mean, this is the same sort of organization that thinks the pouches of applesauce I try to bring onto the plane is actually two guns. So let's not start bringing reason into it now.
I think the reason that the TSA doesn't like it is they see it and they think, oh, a present for me. And then you're like, oh, I'm taking this with me. And they're like, no.
Oh, gosh.
Here's something from No Jolly in This Holly in Tacoma, Washington. Every year, we do a gift exchange on Christmas, but it's the same boring draw-the-numbers-pick-a-gift deal every year. Any suggestions on how to mix up a holiday gift exchange so people don't just fall straight to sleep when it's announced?
Well, you could toss your keys in with your present. Just have everybody do that. I think that would probably spice things up.
Here's what you do. Everybody brings two gifts. One gift is worth a lot of money, and one gift is worth very little money. And then you build a big bonfire in the middle of the room, and everyone has to pick one of the gifts, and the other one, at random, gets thrown into the bonfire,
yes,
and only the person who brought the presents knows.
Oh, that's good.
What about something with an element of danger?
Ooh.
What about a deadly creature, for example?
Yeah,
I mean, like that. What about just a fight to the death where, say, you have 30 people and you only have 29 gifts?
That could be fun.
You could go with a classic that Arnani used to try to employ, lotto tickets, because you don't know how good of a gift it is or how bad. It's just a scratcher. You don't know. Mm. Luck of the draw.
Schrodinger's gift.
Justin, it sounded like you were trying to start a chant at a sporting event.
Yeah, I didn't catch on, though.
Lotto tickets.
I like Jesse's idea. I think just load these things up chock-a-block full of asps, and I know a guy.
Is it Mark Antony?
I can get you 5 asps by the afternoon.
You got a guy? You got an asp guy?
Yeah,
you gotta have an asp guy. Come on.
He prefers, he's more of an asp man.
Okay, here's something from Sad Weeb in San Diego. Every year, my parents ask my siblings and I to make Christmas lists. My problem is, I'm a very big anime fan, and all I really...
End of question!
And all I really want for Christmas is anime merchandise.
Yeah.
However, one year, I put an anime figurine on my list. My mom just glanced at it and said, "You don't need that," and then didn't buy it.
Boo!
Boo, Mom!
Ever since then, I keep putting figurines on my list in hopes of them getting it for me, but to no avail. Help me, brothers. How do you convince my parents that a tasteful figurine of Viktor Nikiforov from my favorite anime, Yuri on Ice, is more important than socks or an ugly Christmas sweater?
The title of that show is stylized with an exclamation point in there. And Jesse, I have to thank you for really, really voicing that.
I'm a professional, Griffin.
I think that what you do is when you hand over the list, it's only got one thing on it. And that's the figurine of Viktor Nikiforov. And then when they're like, no, you just stand your ground and you don't take the list back. And if they try to get you anything else, you build a bonfire. And you throw it into the bonfire.
Get some asps.
That's a terrible idea, Travis. I don't know how he's supposed to play pretend with just one of the Yuri on Ice figures. He can't make them do any, reenact any of their great fights or ice
or
skating
dances.
Or any, here's the thing. My email address is justin@mabimbam.com. Email me, and I will buy you whatever anime figure you want. Don't rely on your family anymore. Rely on me, Justin McElroy.
Justin's your family now.
I'm your family now, and I'm going to buy you an anime figure this year. Congratulations. justin@mabimbam.com. Email me. I will buy you, and this goes for anybody who sent in this question that is this person.
Well,
I will buy you an anime figure of your choice.
Hey, what happened to Justin? Oh, he's broke now.
Yeah.
Broke now. Bought 10,000 Yuri on Ice.
No,
figures.
Just this one person. If someone else has this exact same problem and sent in this exact same question, letter for letter, I will also buy them an anime figurine. I don't want to leave anybody out.
Justin, I had the same problem, but it was with the original Yuri before they put it on ice.
Okay.
Yuri on the rocks.
Yeah.
I tell you, I think you can do a limited list, but put your Yuri on Ice figure on it. And then the only other thing on the list is a big bag of drugs. It can just say 2 pounds of any drug of your choice, mother. And then it's up to them about the path you're going to walk.
Get it? Get two things. One, an anime figurine. The second thing you want is grandpa poison.
Well, Justin, Griffin, Travis, I sure appreciate you taking the time to answer all these questions on the Bullseye Holiday Special. Have you guys got big holiday plans this year for My Brother, and Me?
This is actually it. This is kind of the capstone for me.
I mean, I think that maybe Justin and I and Griffin and I might see each other this year, exchange presents. I think a few of our closest friends are going to come to our Candlelight show in Huntington. But I think that's about it. I think that's about all we have planned.
We're doing our annual charity fundraiser, mabimbamangels.com. If you want to help buy gifts, and items for people in our area, less fortunate folks in our area, we would sure appreciate that too.
So you can find that at mbmbamangels.com.
That's right.
Well, thanks guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. One more treat for you on the Bullseye Holiday Special, a segment we like to call The Song That Changed My Life. It's a chance for musicians, artists, and other creators to tell us about the music that makes them who they are. This time, we're thrilled to welcome Cy Smith.
Yeah. Your love takes me high.
Cy Smith is a brilliant singer, songwriter, and producer. She lives here in Los Angeles. She's originally from Washington, D.C. She's been recording soul records for over a decade now and has collaborated with folks like Kamasi Washington and Thundercat. She's also an incredibly talented backup singer. Name a great, and she's sung with them. Sheila E., Chaka Khan, Usher, Whitney Houston. She just dropped a really fun holiday EP. It's called Christmas in Cyberspace.
Christmas time,
That's cyberspace with an S, by the way, like Cy Smith. When we asked her about the album and if any of the songs on it had a good story we could talk with her about on the show, she talked about My Favorite Things. And boy, she did not let us down. So we won't waste any more time before we get into it. Take it away, Cy.
The first time I heard My Favorite Things was in the movie The Sound of Music, of course.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens, brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things.
I think the first time I saw The Sound of Music, I was about 6 or 7 years old. I was in my mother's bedroom watching it on TV in our apartment in Hillcrest Heights, Maryland.
Cream-colored ponies and crisp apple strudels, doorbells and sleigh bells and schnitzel with noodles, wild geese that fly with the moon on their wings. These are a few of my favorite things.
You know, that melody caught my ear because it was such a distinct melody. As a child, that melody just sounded like a dance to me. It just sounded like la da 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 da. It just sounded like a dance. If a dance could sing, that's what it would sound like.
These are a few of my favorite things. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad.
Even on paper, when you look at it, it looks like a dance, you know? And the things that she was singing about were quite abstract to me, you know, cream-colored ponies and, you know, like, I didn't know anything that she was talking about. I didn't know what a schnitzel was, but that melody made me want to know, you know. So the next time that I heard My Favorite Things, and it really sort of changed my life, was when I might have been about 8 or 9, I had an aunt, my Aunt Bobby, in Teaneck, New Jersey. She had a little radio in the kitchen, and the Coltrane version came on the radio. I didn't recognize it as My Favorite Things, but she began singing it on top of the Coltrane version. And that's when it sort of resonated with me. That's when I went, wait, that's that song from the movie. I hadn't seen the movie repeatedly, so I didn't walk around singing the soundtrack of, you know, The Sound of Music. But when she sang it, it just reminded me of that song, and all of a sudden, I don't know, like it made sense to me. Do you know what I mean? Like all of a sudden, all of those sort of abstract concepts made sense. Like, oh, wow, I can just think of something that I really like and anything that's frightening me will go away. I wasn't listening to jazz at all when I was a kid. And that was the thing. When she started singing this on top of this, it made all of a sudden jazz accessible to me. I think at that point, jazz was just sort of, you know, music that older people listened to. It wasn't something that I would go and put on the record player, you know. But when she started singing it, I was like, oh, jazz is something that you can sing along to. Jazz is something that, you know, you can sort of interpret songs that you already know. Jazz is can be a template. That was sort of a new understanding for me. Like, it was also, it was a discovery. Everything about that song made me curious. The melody made me curious. When I started listening to really what those words were, that made me want to sort of embrace my own writing a little more. And so often I would replace those lyrics with my own long before I did this, you know, my current project, I would always just sort of make up my own lyrics in that same pattern because I thought it would be cool to sing something that really resonated with me, things that really were my favorite things, you know. Jumping on something, swinging on playgrounds, da-da-da-da-da-da, hanging around. Like, it was probably really silly like that. It was always something like that, things that I really like to do. So yeah, when I decided to do a Christmas project, I knew I wanted to record my favorite things. It had been on my mind for 20 years. These are a few of my favorite things. To finally sit down and record this song, it was the easiest thing to me because I felt like I've been thinking about this for so long. So it didn't take me long to sort of even rewriting the lyrics. That was like, I did it in the car on the way to the studio. She's with the laces and oversized glasses, watching my people rise up from the ashes, sharing a smile with that guy on the train. And I didn't have to think too hard because I think those items had been sort of running around my head on and off for the last 20 years. Sunshine down on my sisters and you know, whenever I sing this melody, I just immediately am transported back to my childhood. That just because the melody, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein, they just created something so beautiful with that lilting melody. It just lilts like a, like, I don't know, what lilts in nature? You know, it just, it sounds like a stick figure just sort of becoming curvy all of a sudden. You know what I mean? It just sounds like air all of a sudden becoming a form, you know? It sounds like magic. And so when you sit at the piano and sing this, it's just liberating. It's just a lot of fun. I can't describe it any other way. Knowing you can't keep a good woman.
Cy Smith on the song that changed her life, My Favorite Things. Cy's new Christmas record is called Christmas in Cyberspace. You can stream it now. In New York City, you can see her live. She's performing with the trumpeter Chris Bode every night at the Blue Note, right up until Christmas. That's all for this week's Bullseye. Bullseye is recorded at MaximumFun.org World Headquarters, overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California. It's the holiday season. We want to thank everyone who has been working hard to make life for folks in our neighborhood better. The LA Regional Food Bank, the Dream Center, LAMP, many, many others. We're so grateful to you for your hard work on behalf of us and our neighbors. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. Jesus Ambrosio is our associate producer. We get help from Casey O'Brien here at Max Fun. Our production fellow at MaximumFun.org is Shayna Deloria. Our interstitial music this week comes from Brent Weinbach. You can go see Brent Weinbach's amazing comedy. He is not just a skilled pianist. He is really, truly one of the funniest comics out there. He has a stand-up special on Amazon called Appealing to the Mainstream. He is doing a show at SF Sketchfest on opening night, January 10th, at the Gateway Theater. And he's hosting and producing a New Year's Eve show at the Grand Lake in Oakland, California, including our friend Jonah Ray and lots of other hilarious comics. If you're in the Bay for Christmas Eve, and you can't go wrong with the Grand Lake, ever. One of the great theaters in America. Our theme music is by the Go Team, thanks to them and their label Memphis Industries for providing it to us. If you'd like to hear any of our past programs, there are hundreds on our website. Just go to MaximumFun.org. We're also on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. And I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.